Hello and welcome to Minbar. The question of Islam in the West, the spread of Islam in the West. When we look at the West, we see that there are some key areas where Islam at least has a presence that is becoming more and more problematic for these secular governments and Christian countries. We're talking about places like France, places like the United States, and also England or the United Kingdom. For many people, many non-Muslims in the West, the whole question or the whole idea of a Muslim presence, a powerful Muslim presence in their midst, was something that they were ignorant of until after 1911. And when we look at this Muslim presence, we find that in all three areas, or on both continents, this presence has, this contemporary presence, began in the 60s with the immigration of Muslims from different parts of the world to the West. And also, like, for example, in the United States, the growth of a fairly indigenous Muslim community of converts in the United States. But if we go even further back, there has always been, for a long time, a close relationship between the West and Islam. Now we're in the present and are facing the future, especially after 9/11, and we are asking ourselves, what is the future of Islam in the West? Where are we going? Where are we as Muslims? Where are we going? And where would those powers that are not friendly to Islam would like us to go? What are they doing? What are the factors among ourselves that are keeping us back from presenting a proper face of Islam and encouraging its growth? What are these factors that we possess within ourselves, among ourselves? And what are the efforts of those powers that are anti-Islamic doing to prevent us from achieving our goals? This we'd like to ask with our esteemed guest, Dr. Yaqub Zaki from Scotland, the United Kingdom. He is director or deputy director of the Muslim Institute of London, a very prominent and active group that has been on the Islamic scene in England for over 20 years, and who was also a visiting professor at Harvard University in the area of Islamic architecture. Apparently, Dr. Yaqub Zaki is one of the few Muslim experts we have on Islamic architecture and art. So we're quite pleased to have him here. And today we will talk about the question of Islam in the United Kingdom. What is the future of Islam in the United Kingdom? Dr. Zaki, welcome to Minbar. I understand this is your first a trip to Iran.
First, it's my fifth.
Your fifth?
I was here twice,
okay,
under the Shah, uh-huh, on film assignments,
right,
and then twice afterward attending conferences, during the first of which I saw, if I did not meet, Imam Khomeini.
Okay.
And then this is my fifth, again, to attend a conference.
We're glad to have you back. Apparently you had converted when you were 15 years old. That's almost like 47 years ago.
Yes.
And at that time, I mean, there was no Muslim, great Muslim presence in the UK. How did you convert?
There was no foreign Muslim presence in the UK worth mentioning, but there was a substantial indigenous presence.
Well, is that so?
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit more about it?
In fact, Islam in Britain goes back to the 8th century AD. The earliest evidence we have for the existence of a Muslim community in Britain is a single coin in the British Museum. It's a gold dinar minted by King Offa of Mercia in the 8th century, which has the Kalima, and it's minted in the name of Mansur, the first Abbasid caliph, and the founder of Baghdad. Now, to mint such a coin...
8th century?
8th century. And to mint such a coin, he must have employed Muslim workmen in the Mercian mint.
Now, where's Mercia?
Mercia is in the Midlands. It was the largest of the various states into which England was divided at that time. So you can say Islam has been in England before England was England.
Interesting. And how did it get there to Mercia? Is there any evidence, any historical accounts of how it got
there? It got there through trade.
Uh-huh.
And this you can prove by looking at Al-Idrisi's map, which was made in Sicily in the 12th century AD. And the south coast of England is depicted with extraordinary accuracy, almost like a modern survey map. And the especially Cornwall, which shows that the Muslims had been trading with the south of England, and particularly Cornwall, for tin, because without tin you cannot make bronze.
Right.
And without bronze you can't have weapons or cooking vessels or anything. And this has been going on since long before Islam. The Carthaginians were trading with Cornwall for tin from 2000 BC.
So we're talking about 2 centuries after the founding of Islam.
The spread of Islam was very, very rapid. I mean, Islam was in China within a century of the death of Rasulullah.
Right. So now, okay, but at the time you became a Muslim, there wasn't any no sizable Islamic presence in England to...
Statistically, no, but intellectually, yes, because people had been converting to Islam since the time of the Crusades. Especially in the 16th century, with the Berberi pirates, that when they took prisoners, often they would convert to Islam. And when these people grew homesick and returned to Britain, sometimes they had to be rebaptized. And this was one of the problems that confronted Archbishop Laud at the beginning of the 17th century. But sometimes they retained their Islamic identity. And then when we come down to the 18th century, we find the first case of aristocratic conversion. You know that at that time, I'm speaking of the 18th, 19th and early 20th centuries, the converts to Islam were drawn from 3 social groups. One was the aristocracy, because the aristocracy have always been eccentrics. An eccentric simply means somebody who is away from the centre,
right.
And the centre in this case was Anglicanism.
Uh-huh.
Another was the army officer class, who sometimes converted in the countries to which they were assigned. I knew the last of them, Colonel Abdullah Bain Stewart. He converted in Iraq. And you know, the cultural context has a lot to do with it, because he converted in Iraq, he became Shi'i, like my friend, Marion Davis, who was married to the agricultural attaché in the British Embassy here in Tehran. And she converted to Islam, and since this is the cultural context, she became Ithnashiri. And then the third group was the rubber planters in Malaysia, who sometimes married Malaysian wives. And when they retired, they brought Islam back with them to Britain. Because, you know, it's a bit easier to marry Malaysian girls or Moroccan girls than it is to marry girls from Egypt and certain other countries. I don't know about Iran. Maybe you can tell me.
Now, when you converted, did you convert somebody converted you, brought Islam to you?
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yes.
Because it seems there are two routes of conversion. One is through chance encounter with some charismatic personality, and the other is through your own reading, in which the person discovers Islam for himself. Now, you must remember, my father was a marine engineer. That's the most Scottish of all professions. Down to the Second World War, you would not meet a marine engineer anywhere in the British mercantile marine who was not Scottish. Mm. So I was born in a port. It was a small town of 80,000 people, and I was the only Muslim in that 80,000 and the only Muslim in my middle-class school. So you can imagine that I was a marked man.
Right.
So how could I come to Islam? Just through chance encounter with Rodwell's translation of the Quran.
Uh-huh.
And let me take the opportunity of this program to put over a certain point of view that I wish every convert could begin by reading Rodwell's translation. Not because he was pro-Islamic, he was hostile to Islam, but because the translation is the Nizami Tanzil. Now, a convert, when he reads the Quran, beginning with Surat al-Alaq, Surat al-Mudaffar, he re-experiences within himself the experience, the tajriba of the Prophet when the Wahi came to him.
Mm.
And many Muslims forget the Prophet was himself a convert. So it's very important for converts to follow this route.
Uh-huh. And then you say that this version of the Quran is one of the best ones for a convert to read?
because it is the Nizami Tanzil. But from a literary point of view, it's vastly superior to Yusuf al-Ali.
Nizami Tanzil, for the audience who don't know what it means, is in terms of the order of revelation.
Yeah, the sequence of revelation.
Yes, the sequence of revelation.
It's arranged with the first surah to be revealed, surah al-Alaq, then surah al-Mudathir, and so on.
As opposed to the more prevalent official...
because surah al-Baqarah and the early surahs, they contain a lot of Medinan legislation. That can be difficult for a person to absorb at the first encounter, whereas the inspirational, literary, revelational character of the early surahs chronologically can have a greater impact on a fresh mind.
Wow. So, what category did you fit in? You were not a lord.
Oh, I fitted into the second.
You were a soldier.
No, not even an aristocrat. I was just middle class.
Right. So, were there many middle class Britons at that time converting to Islam, like yourself, in different parts of the country, perhaps?
Oh yes. I mean, I'm just one of several.
And most of them were reading, converted through reading. There were no people coming to them and bringing Islam to them.
No, right? I think it was both ways. Sometimes they were assigned to teaching posts in Muslim countries, and they were very impressed with the Muslim way of life.
Right.
And there's been active dawah in Britain since the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And again, that was indigenous effort. It was not brought from without.
Right.
It was Abdullah Quilliam, a solicitor in Liverpool, who went to Morocco and got converted in Tangier. And then when he came back, he started to spread Islam in Britain. And he worked mainly amongst amongst native British people.
Mm-hmm.
And the social spectrum of them, unlike the Surrey Muslims, because Surrey is one of the home counties and it's rather upper class, aristocratic, unlike the Surrey Muslims based on the focus of Woking from 1889 onward, the Liverpool Muslims have a complete spectrum of the social class in Britain, all the way from aristocracy right down to ordinary working people in the Liverpool docks.
So now, did this community of Muslims, this community of indigenous British Muslims, did they create a sense of community among themselves? Did they have, for example, organizations, associations, centers where they could frequent and so on?
Oh, yes. The Woking Mosque was founded in 1889. Then it closed on Dr. Leitner's death, and it reopened in 1914. And for long, that was the hub of Islam in Britain. As for Liverpool, we are now restoring the original buildings occupied by Abdullah Quilliam as an Islamic heritage center.
Okay.
And there at one time, there was a museum, a library, a lecture hall, all in addition to a mosque.
And so, apart from the fact that you have these centers existing as historical, sites and so on, do these original converts, the descendants, their followers?
No, they died out. I mean, a family like the Howards in Surrey no longer exists. Again, I knew the last of them, a lady. And as for Abdullah Quilliam, of his six children, only two kept the faith, and that for one generation. So you can say that in the third generation, Islam died out.
Right.
I'm glad you raised this point, because this touches on one problem, that at that time, a lot of the indigenous converts were male. Remember I said there were the three categories, the aristocracy, the army officer class, male by definition, the rubber planters, again, male by definition. The lack of Muslim women for them to marry led to an extinction of Islam in one or two generations.
Okay, so now we're entering the second phase of the spread of Islam.
You mean the mass immigration of the 60s?
Yes.
Yes,
that's
well, it's had
them,
both
yes.
positive and negative effects.
But I mean, even though it may have negative effects, they also had some kind of role to play in converting people to Islam, didn't they?
Yes, but you see, they are drawn for the most part from the most unsophisticated sectors of the population in the countries they come from. For instance, very backward districts of Pakistan, like Mirpur, and they bring with them their own educational backwardness. So they are not able really to communicate Islam to the British people.
But this was the beginning of the 60s and so on.
Yes.
Right.
The picture is changing now because there is emerging a generation of native-born British people. They have British nationality, but they're of Indo-Pakistani origin. But they are born in Britain. They don't have any of the inhibitions of the post-colonial hangovers of their parents' generation. I mean, their parents' generation were brought up in the colonies to believe that the British were a race of demigods.
Right.
And as you know, all that's happened with the so-called independence of the Muslim countries, except here in the case of Iran, is that the brown sahibs have replaced the white, the coconuts we call them, brown inside, white inside, because they are educated to believe that the British are a master race. And although they will not admit this to you, in their heart of hearts, they are convinced of this. But the younger generation have been to school with the British, and they know the British are just like any other people.
I think this is a universal problem with a lot of Muslims, you know. Everywhere. I even see it among, for example, a discriminatory type of a behavior between, let's for example, white Muslims and black Muslims. You know, white people from America who are Muslims,
black
people
to give their daughters in marriage to blacks.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not only. I mean, they refuse to give their daughters in marriage to us whites as well.
Uh-huh.
I mean, when their daughters come of marriageable age, they are whisked off to Pakistan and married to their bloody cousins.
Right.
Now, I mean, this does nothing to promote the spread of Islam, does it?
Right.
So you've got a girl who has got A levels or at least O levels, sometimes a university education. She's whiffed off to Multan and she's married to a goatherd. Imagine what kind of marriage is that? I mean, it collapses inside 5 years because she despises the husband.
So what do you think are the factors to be blamed? We have mentioned a couple, for example, the outward-looking type of attitude, or we should say, backward-looking type of attitude, because they're looking back to their home country
introspective,
you know, yes, and introspective, and so on.
Racist, and based on endogamic marriage.
Now,
and this is a reversion to the values of the Jahiliyyah.
This is
true. We have to look at the situation in the Arabian Peninsula before the advent of Islam. The state did not exist; it was a tribal society. The tribe was the social and political unit. Now, in such a context, morality in the Quranic or Christian of any other sense that did not exist. What was good was anything that promoted the cohesion of the tribe. Bad was anything that detracted from tribal cohesion. And therefore, prior to Rasulullah, you had female infanticide because a woman cannot be a warrior.
Right.
And similarly, you had cousin marriage. So the best marriage, and many Muslims still practice this, although we've had 1400 years of Islam, is with the daughter of your father's brother, and the second best, the daughter of your father's sister. And you can even come into this world already engaged, because two girls growing up together in the same household will agree that if they have children of opposite sex, they will marry them off to each other. Now, I ask you, what does this do to promote the spread of Islam?
Right. But, to be fair to some of these communities, right, you find like there's a whole lot of young people today, you know, who have grown up, who were born in England, born in the United States.
Yes, and they're rebelling against these
types of things, right?
Yes.
And you find that, for example, the efforts of these types of young people tending to be much more effective in the spread of Islam, in the establishment of Islam, in this new environment. Now,
okay, but can I stop you at this point? Before we go any further, we have to consider the role of the indigenous converts,
right,
or sometimes converts in the second generation whose fathers converted. Now, back in the 1920s, the proportion of converts to immigrant Muslims was 10%. Today, it is not even a fraction of 1%. And the reason is because they have been outnumbered by this mass immigration. The result is there are not sufficient converts proportionally to act as a bridge between Islam and the host community.
But couldn't we look at that simply as a quantitative type of a way of looking? When you look at it qualitatively, you know, you still find converts being very active in the conversion, you know, in the spread of Islam, very active, acting as go-betweens between the state and the Muslim community. You find, for example, in Finland, a couple of weeks ago, we did an interview with a sister from Finland, a Finnish convert to Islam, who was quite effective in acting as a go-between. We find, for example, in CARE in the United States, some of the leadership of CARE are converts who are spokesmen about Islam, which is Ibrahim Hooper, for example. For example, you yourself, I mean, the Crescent International, you found that people who wrote in for the Crescent International, many of them, apart from, you know, enlightened Muslims, you find converts who also had, you know, something important to say, writing in for these magazines.
Yes.
Could it be just a question, a numbers game, really? I mean, when you look at it, maybe yes. Okay, the immigration is great, you know, but the quality of work is what counts?
That certainly is a factor, but this quality varies from country to country. Now, you take Britain. Our most famous convert to Islam is Yusuf Islam, but Yusuf is a pop star. He has no higher education, nothing above all levels, and though he is quite articulate, I mean, how is he to converse on a high dialectical level? Whereas in France, for instance, the converts are people like Roger Garoudi, who are top-level intellectuals. So I find this varies from country to country. But the country where most conversions are taking place at the moment is Germany, and it's even got
Germany?
Oh yes, Germany, and it's even got the German government worried because they say this can lead to a spread of terrorism.
Now we're talking about what you know. There are two types of conversions, largely, you know, male conversion and female conversion. Largely, female conversion tends to be conversion through marriage.
Well, maybe not largely, but a significant amount.
Yeah.
In Britain, twice the number of women convert to, although we are told Islam is a misogynistic religion, which is against women. I mean, this is one of the part of the leyenda negra, the, you know, the black legend. That
okay, some of the black legend, because we're just out of time. We have to take a break for a news break, and we'll come back about
the black legend.
The black legend. Stay tuned with us. We will be right back after this news break. Thank you. And welcome back to Mimbar. And we are here talking with Dr. Yaqub Zaki about the spread of Islam in Europe and America. And we're talking about Germany, of all places, being a place where Islam is being spread more rapidly in the midst of all these anti-Turkish racism and so forth and so on. You know, Turks go back home and so forth. Islam is spreading more rapidly in Germany.
Yes.
And you mentioned, despite the black legend, meaning the propaganda, the anti-Islamic propaganda.
The negative portrayal of Islam in the media. Yes.
Why is Islam spreading so fast in Germany?
I think it may be a reaction against the American domination of Germany. Mm. A younger generation is American who do not feel any guilt for the Second World War and want to liberate themselves from the post-war system, which is a Pax Americana imposed on Europe, because you know what the United States did during the Second World War was to use Britain as an Anglo-Saxon beachhead for the invasion, conquest and subjugation of Europe. And that's the meaning of NATO. The name of the subjugation is NATO, a market for American military hardware.
But what relationship does that have to do with Islam? Why would people embrace Islam to...
But Islam is an alternative system. It's, I mean, Islam is a totalist system. It's not just religion, it's politics, it's etiquette, it's aesthetics, it's everything. That's the difference between a religion and a deen. Islam is a deen. Christianity is only a religion.
Now, in Germany, is this conversion taking place largely among women? For example, women marrying Turkish men, for example, or are men also embracing...
Well, that's part of it, like women marrying Algerian men in France, or Pakistani men in Britain. Because whilst the Pakistani males do not mind marrying white women, they object to their daughters doing so. However, you see, Islam is portrayed in the media as a misogynistic religion, which represses women. The media never mention two statistics, that the number of women converts to Islam is twice that of male converts, in America three times.
Right. And how does, for example, disasters you know, 9/11, for example, the Rushdie affair and so on, do they have any effect upon the growth or the suppression of Islam in
the
West?
They've had the opposite effect to what Salman Rushdie and the authors of 9/11 intended, the real authors, I mean. Because after Rushdie, the rate of conversion in Britain increased four times, and possibly abroad, since it was an international scandal. Mm. And the reason was simply most people had not thought about Islam until that moment. But suddenly, when they were reading about it in the newspapers, and you know, human nature is so constituted that when a thing is portrayed as black, 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 somehow or other, it becomes positively attractive, you know. It's part of the perversity of human nature, and therefore it led people to inquire about Islam and ultimately for some to convert.
What happened in 9/11? You say, apart from what the real architects of 9/11 intended, who do you think are the real architects of 9/11?
Well,
and what do you think they intended?
I'm speaking from American. You're right. An American, aren't you? Right. I mean, what do you think the motivation was for the American Civil War? Come now. Tell me.
The domination of the North over the South, the domination of industrialism.
Well, secession of the Southern states, yes, their forced reincorporation into the Union. But look, they decree freeing the slaves was only at the second year of the war. So it could not have been the motivation for the war. The real motivation for the American Civil War was that the industrialists of the North looked with envy on this pool of cheap labour which the plantation economy had in the South, and through the so-called Reconstruction, in fact, which was the destruction of the South, these people would be forced to flee North, where they constituted the black ghettos in the cities, and they had that pool of cheap labour. And in comparison with slavery, which is a humane system, it's security from the cradle to the grave. I mean, in industrial society, there's no security. You're out.
Yeah,
once you
I agree. It's relative. It's relative.
Yes.
But going back to 9/11.
No. Let's go back to history. What about the American Spanish War, but whereby America was able to grab the last American colonies? Through occupying Cuba, America was able to extend her hegemony all over the whole of the Caribbean. And through taking the Philippines from Spain, she was able to extend her hegemony over both the Pacific.
So 9/11 is to extend American hegemony
over
the rest
like,
of the...
Like Pearl Harbor, which was also a plot.
I just wanted to hear you to say it through your own mouth, that 9/11
was... Well, you see, you're giving me freedom to speak here, but they won't give me this freedom to speak in Britain.
I understand. An attempt to increase American hegemony all over the world, and I would presume also to stifle the spread of Islam in the United States of America, which was expanding very, very, very rapidly.
Yes. Now, you're amongst the dispossessed classes.
Now, about the future of Islam in Britain. We see, whenever somebody goes to Britain, you know, you see basically the evidence of Islam practically everywhere, especially in the bigger cities, you know, London, Manchester, Birmingham, and so on. You know, you see big mosques, you see Muslims. Largely tends to be a sort of a subcontinental type of a flavor.
Look, we don't have any Islam in Britain. Let me be quite plain.
So let's
in Britain,
about,
we have Pakistani mosques in which the khutbah is in Urdu. Mm. We have Bengali mosques in which the khutbah is in Bengali. We even have one Albanian mosque in which the khutbah is in Albanian. We don't have any Muslim mosques.
Well, they're all Muslim.
But they're all
I would say they're practicing their own particular indigenous version of Islam. I can't say they're
indigenous,
not Muslim.
They're imported.
But when you say not Muslim mosques, I would assume you mean not British Muslim mosques.
No. I mean mosques in which the khutbah is in Arabic or with an English translation, because the khutbah should be in the language comprehensible to the majority of the congregants in any particular congregation.
Which should be English.
Yes. Apart from the liturgical portions of the khutbah,
right,
you know.
Right, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think there are a comparable number of mosques in Britain that that have the khutbah in English. Maybe not all of them.
No.
But there are some.
Well, let's take another thing. The architecture of these mosques. Do you think that these mosques, which are designed by British architects who don't know the first thing about the liturgical bases of mosque design, are a good advertisement for Islam? What about the one in London, for which I was the advisor? And I think I made it worse. The Regent's Park Mosque. Mm-hmm. The architect was Sir Frederick Gibbert, who was the architect of Paddy's Wigwam, you know, the Catholic cathedral in Liverpool, which is a monstrosity. And Regent's Park is another monstrosity. Now there, above all, in London, in the heart of England's capital, we should have had a mosque that through its beauty attracted people to Islam, whatever the style, Egyptian, Turkish, whatever, I don't care. But it should have been a beacon drawing people to Islam.
So why would somebody, and I think this is a problem that many Muslim communities have in Canada and America, different parts there, they invite non-Muslim architects to design
exactly.
their mosques.
In Britain, they take the yellow pages for their local town or city, and they choose some architect out of it, picking him with a pin. He doesn't know the first thing.
Why would they do something like this? I mean, what leads
them to
do something
like this? Because of the ignorance of them. Don't you realise the mosque committees are dominated by the cash and carry waller, the takeaway tycoon, men of no education. So how can they discern? They don't know Islamic architecture from Christian architecture from Jewish. There is no Jewish architecture.
So now you're saying that, what we're saying is one of the biggest problems in the Islamic communities are these boards of directors?
Yes, it's the low cultural level. Uh-huh. Yes.
Who do not have a clear understanding of Islam.
And the same with the importation of imams. One of our biggest problems is the problem of importing imams, because they come from backward areas of Pakistan like Punjab and Mirpur. So along with that imam, you impart his ignorance. Well, maybe that's not so bad, but he's teaching in a madrasa. So he imparts that ignorance to the next generation of Muslims. I mean, look, when the imam in a British mosque falls vacant, what happens? Somebody on the mosque committee, maybe the cash and carry waller, he says, my nephew, naming a village in the Punjab, is Hafiz al-Quran, let's bring him over. What he really wants is to bring over another member of his family to Britain.
Mm. Now, I mean, okay, you find, let's say, among Orthodox Christians, they tend to have their own types of mosques. You have Orthodox Greek, Orthodox, I don't know, Russian, and so forth.
Yes.
You know, in these areas, there's one Orthodox church, but just these different branches practice their own culture.
And the Uniate churches, yes, because they have the liturgy in their own language.
Yes.
Greek, Romanian, whatever,
exactly.
Russian.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's the difference between these people and these other Muslim people?
I don't see any difference.
Right.
They are uprooted communities which have been transplanted into a different cultural and linguistic context, and they try desperately to hold on to their identity.
Right.
Which in the case of the Muslims in Britain, I mean, Islam in Britain is a Pakistani church in exile.
Right.
So what they're holding on to is an identity which they think is Islamic, but it's nothing of the kind. It's subcontinental. 90% of it comes from Hinduism.
So you mentioned Pakistani and, for example, Indian Muslims, Bengali Muslims, in India, in England. Mm. What about other Muslims? What about African Muslims, Arab Muslims, and so on? Do they have the same problems? Do they have the same attitude?
African Muslims, they are very dispersed. I mean, they go to these Pakistani Bengali mosques and that, where they form a small, somewhat alienated minority. But Arabs we do have. And intelligentsia who have fled from their own country because they cannot, an intellectual cannot live with these dictatorships.
Mm. Mm. So part of the exerting one's force, one's presence on one's environment is in the political and social sphere.
Mm.
You know, you find, for example, the Jewish community in the United States of America, for example, while at the same time remaining separate or exclusive to one particular group, can exert itself and cause an impact upon the political scene. You find that, for example, Sikhs in some parts of Ontario, for example, exert themselves on the political scene. So in Britain, do you see any type of movement in that particular regard? For example, Muslims exerting themselves on the political scene and making their voices be heard, even though those voices might be scattered or might not have a unity?
No, they joined the bloody Labour Party, Lord Nasir Ahmed, who is a millionaire. He made his millions frying fish and chips. He gives money to the Labour Party that put him into the House of Lords.
So all of them are joining the Labour Party? I mean, joining the Labour Party could be...
There was a process of embourgeoisement, you know, amongst those businessmen getting rich. And then they join the Conservative Party. But look, it's only the difference of fee, fi, fo, fum. I mean, the two parties are just the same, opposite sides of one and the same, right. The same coin. I mean, you take this dreadful man, Tony Blair, whom we've just got rid of, but he is succeeded by Brown, who is the first Scottish Prime Minister for 80 years, and before that there was no Scotsman Prime Minister in number 10 for 200 years. It's very difficult for a Scotsman to become Prime Minister.
You mustn't have any inroads on Brown.
And therefore, to become it, he has to beat the British drum. He says, why don't Muslims salute the Union, why don't British people salute the Union Jack? Why don't they fly the flag in their gardens and this sort of thing? So don't think that this man will be any better than what we've just got rid of. Now, the alternative to that is Cameron, who is now leading in the polls. But Cameron was an employee of the Rothschilds. So it makes no difference. It's just one Jewish or Zionist agent after another.
No, if you look at, for example, modern democracy... Okay.
Well, I don't believe democracy exists.
Apart from the question of whether democracy is real or not.
It's a plutocracy ruled by money.
But hear me out. Modern democracy tends to be very much dominated by the lobby group.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes, particularly in the
These
States,
governments tend to reflect the will and the wishes of those who give them a fatter banknote to support their election campaigns and so on.
Yeah, right. That is, you have depicted the picture of the political scene in the United States, but not to the same degree in Britain.
I see. But in other words, economic power has a very profound role to play upon government.
But economic power in Britain is centred in the city. In that square mile, you have more riches than possibly anywhere else in the world. So when people talk about the disappearance of the British Empire, it's still there as a financial imperium governing the country from the city.
Now, Muslims, with their economic clout, Muslims who occupy a particular area, do they or could they exert influence upon those people who are running for parliament and so on in their area?
Now, it's interesting you should say this, because the leaders of the Khalistan government in exile came...
The Khalistan government.
Khalistan government, you know, which is the Sikh movement for Sikh independence in the eastern Punjab.
Khalistan, right?
Khalistan, yes, land of the pure, you see. They came to me and several other people about 15 years ago, and they had done their homework, unlike the Muslims. They had taken the population counts of the various voting constituencies in Britain, worked out what was the proportion of Muslims in certain quarters, what was the proportion of Sikhs, and they showed that Sikhs by themselves could not put in an MP who would be subservient to the wishes of that group, because, you know, every MP has to declare an interest in entering Parliament. The Muslims could not put in an MP of their own or any other religious domination who would reflect the interests of their particular group. But they said that combined, there were certain constituencies that they could control. But this never became a practical reality, although I at the time thought it was worth exploring.
Yeah. Why did it not become a practical reality?
Well, because there have been so many wars between Sikhs and Muslims back in we are the victims of history.
Right. But couldn't these guys put that aside and find new common ground in a new land?
Well, I should like to see it, yes.
So what is the hope for the future? I mean, what do Muslims have to do? What type of attitudes should Muslims have?
The future is not rosy, because the future is conditioned by the present, just as the present is conditioned by the past. Past, present, and future, all these are linked in a causal sequence. So what will take place in the future is a consequence of what is happening now. And the Muslims are an alienated, persecuted minority, which again puts people who are maybe on the verge of conversion, it puts them off. Because they are frightened. Do you know that the number of indigenous Muslims in Britain, we're speaking of white British Muslims, is estimated to be anywhere between 12 and 15,000, not more than 15,000.
That's quite small.
The number of crypto-Muslims, how many do you think there are? 3 to 4 times that number of Muslims who are Muslim but hide their identity because they're scared.
3 to 4 times that number?
Yeah. Crypto-Muslims outnumber confessing Muslims by 3 to 4 times. It's an astonishing statistic. It shows the ambience of fear that we live in.
So we're talking about the future, creating a better Islam in the future, right? What do we need to do in the present?
Well, look, I mean, I said the future is not rosy, but there are qualifying factors. Now, one is that there is a demographic crisis in Europe. It used to be that France was a dying country. The definition of a dying country is a country in which the number of deaths exceed the number of childbirths.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The government were giving huge amounts of money to people to have large families simply to combat this trend. Then it was Italy. Imagine, all these are Catholic countries, you know, which put the stress on large families.
Right.
At the moment, it's Spain. Can you believe it? Franco Spain, where I grew up, and now only 40% of people will go to church, which raises another question. Christianity everywhere is a dying religion, and therefore Muslims ought to be taking advantage of this situation the way Christians in the Roman Empire took advantage of the fact that Greco-Roman paganism was dying. And therefore that's why Christianity spreads so quickly throughout the whole Roman Empire. Now, in consequence of this demographic crisis, this is what's got politicians in Belgium, Switzerland, France, all of these people really worried. Because the number of Muslims is increasing, the number of Christians or post-Christians, secular Christians, is decreasing in relation to the number of Muslims. Not only that, but why is there so much hostility to the entry of Turkey into the common market, or the EC as it's now called?
Right.
Well, that will bring in, Turkey is a huge population. If Turkey enter the common market, together with 5 million Muslims in France, almost as many in Germany, between 2 and 3 million in Britain, and large communities scattered elsewhere, Holland, Scandinavia, etc. That means that possibly 20% of the population of a united Europe will be Muslim. Now, that is a substantial minority. And if we do achieve that, we shall be in a position to exert political pressure on our politicians.
Would they let this happen? I mean, for example, somebody was saying that the Bosnian war, the Serb Muslim war,
it was genocide.
Was a genocide, was an attempt by Europe to eradicate white Muslim European population and try to relegate Islam to just simply a religion of the darkest skinned people of the world.
An Asian religion, alien to Europe. I went round on fundraising tours in Britain to raise funds for arms for Bosnia. I don't know how I wasn't in prison, because some friends of mine were arrested. But after I gave one talk, people rushed up to me and said, look, we want to enlist. Just tell me, what office do I go to? They can fly me to Sarajevo. I don't mind if I get killed. I'll be Shaheed. And they would say a very significant thing. I didn't know that there were European Muslims. In other words, the history of Islam in Spain and in the Balkans has been kept dark from them.
Yes.
And the basic motivation for the attempted genocide of the Bosnians was the fear that this would give Turkey a foothold in Europe, because nobody knew when Turkey would go Islamic, and already it's happening, you see? And this again would be the horse tails before the walls of Vienna all over again.
So now what do we
They live in terror of Islam.
Right.
I mean, let's be frank. Islam and Christendom have confronted each other as alternative and mutually exclusive cultures from opposite sides of the Mediterranean for 1400 years. And the present situation is part of that ongoing battle.
What do we need to do to win this battle? What attitude changes should Muslims make? What should Muslims prioritize?
Well look, the way I see it is the basic problem that we address is how to decolonization of the Muslim mind. And this can only come about the way the colonization of the Muslim mind came about in the first place, and that is through education. And these madrasas that we have teaching people the Quran by heart when they don't know its meaning, it's not going to do anything. We need to set up international Islamic universities in the West. Okay, right. Iran, we know, with the price of oil, the economy is booming. They could easily set up an international university in Iran. But you know what people will say. They'll say this is a Shiite plot. And if you set it up in Saudi Arabia, they'll say, and with better reason, this is the Wahhabi plot. It's the Salafis. So it has to be in a non-Muslim country that we have these universities. And they will attract people to Islam if Islam be posed in intellectual terms, which it's not at the moment. I mean, the embarrassment caused us by the kind of people they send to represent Islam in the West. Like, for instance, the Secretary General of the Islamic Council of Europe, Salam Azam, the nephew of the Secretary General of the Arab League. He's given that job simply because he belongs to a famous political family in the Middle East which served the British for generations. I mean, he couldn't even pass an elementary examination in Islamic theology, such as I said for my Christian students at Lancaster.
Right. Now, so you mentioned education as a very important factor. What else is there in terms of community organization, the structure of the community, the leadership, cultural aspects?
Well, I think the initiative has to be taken by the immigrant Muslims.
The whole issue of matrimony.
I mean, there are many British Muslims who would be more than happy to marry some beautiful Pakistani girl if she's whisked off, and as I said before, married to a goat herd. How do you think such a person feels? I mean, he becomes totally disillusioned. You know the phrase, the only thing that spoils France is the French. So the only thing that spoils Islam is the Muslims. We have ourselves to blame. We are our own worst enemies.
But wouldn't it be difficult, though? I mean, for example, that culture, that family culture that would think in this way.
Not family culture. Tribal culture.
That tribal culture, even.
Yes.
For a girl getting married to somebody, for example, an indigenous Briton, wouldn't there be a cultural clash in this particular case?
Well, yes, it requires readjustment on both sides.
So should we be talking about
a lot of the cultural assumptions? I mean, all the cultural baggage that the Pakistanis carry with them, what if it's not Islamic to begin with?
We are out of time, I'm sorry. But I think we ended up on two very interesting notes. One is education, an education that is relevant to us as Muslims living in the West, living in this modern world. And secondly, the question of culture, the evolution and development of a Islamic culture that is particular and relevant to the area of the world that we are living in, which is in particular Britain, in terms of this discussion, or in the West in general. I'd like to thank Dr. Yaqub Zaki for joining us at Press TV for a very enlightening and enjoyable discussion. And I hope that you will join us again sometime in the future on Mimbar. And I will see you next week, same time, same channel. Have a good evening.